Samadhi, then you are a good meditator. Yes, so if you sit down and you're able, not all the time, because meditation often varies a lot. Sometimes you get into a nice meditation, other times you don't. So even someone who is a good meditator will get samadhi maybe only occasionally. You're not getting occasionally, but maybe regularly, not all the time. Yeah? So that is kind of the idea. But what the Buddha says in the sutta is that the idea is that you're able to get into the jhanas without trouble and difficulty. Yeah, so if you're the kind of person to get into the jhanas without trouble and difficulty, that is what you're kind of aiming for. And that is possible to do in an aspect life if you have developed your mind well, because you haven't got so many distractions, so you can kind of stay the kuti, come out for the meal, come back again. And then it's possible to develop your mind in this way. But in daylight, it's almost impossible. But there's just too many distractions, unless you live a very special kind of day life where you're kind of not doing very much. You have a good job, you have a good family, or whatever. Yeah. Then, of course, it's different. But for most lay people, that's very hard to do that. But when you come on retreat, that is when you kind of can do these kind of things as a lay person. But rather than judge your meditation by whether you get into good samadhi or not, a much better way of judging your meditation is to see whether you are actually improving in your meditation. And this is what the Buddha said we should really be doing. So ask yourself, are you getting better? Yeah, we're not getting better, because that makes it too personal. Is the meditation improving over time? That is what you should ask yourself. So, come to a meditation center, whether it's here or ideally maybe a bit more secluded, and then see how your meditation goes. Yeah? And then come back 6 months or a year later and see again, and see what's happening in your mind. And if you see that there is an improvement, then you are a good meditator. Yeah? So if you kind of think at 100 miles an hour 1 year, and the next year only think at 80 miles an hour, yay! Improvement in my meditation practice. Yeah? Because you're slowing down a little bit, things are going in the right direction. Don't set the bar too high. Don't kind of be upset with yourself because you don't get all the bliss and happiness and joy. If you get upset with yourself, you're going to make it worse, even more difficult to get into these things in the future. If you see that improvement, wow, you know that you're heading in the right direction. If you keep on going in the right direction, eventually you're going to have some really, really good results. If you are a good meditator, you have a good meditation, yeah, but then you kind of stabilize, or it goes backwards, it doesn't go forwards, then you have some nice meditation, but you're not actually going anywhere. Well, that doesn't do that very much good. Yeah, you're not actually headed in the right direction. That kind of is a blockage there. And if you keep on investigating and looking at your meditation in this way, it has some very good benefits. If you see that your meditation is not really improving, is not going anywhere, you should always ask yourself why that is the case. And there's a very simple solution to that. The main reason why is because you are not being diligent enough with your sila in daily life. That is the main reason why meditation isn't going anywhere. So ask yourself if you can improve your confidence somehow. Can I be more kind, more generous, more compassionate in my daily life? Yeah? Then you find when you go back on a retreat, 1 year later on, then you actually are succeeding. The meditation has improved because the basis, the foundation for the meditation has been put into place. So it's very simple, actually. Yeah, everything in Buddhism is very, it's kind of simple, but you have to kind of approach it in the right way. And when you do that, things will work out. In the meditation practice, the quality of your meditation does not depend so much on how much meditation you do. It depends much more on your ability to live well. even if you don't do any meditation at all the year, but you live really well, yeah, with a good heart, then when you go to the meditation center, you will still have, you will have good meditation as a consequence. So that is actually much more important, because that is the foundation stone for meditation to work. Same thing with right view. Yes, this is a Dhamma talk. Try to align your view, your outlook, with the view of the Buddha. As you do that, you will start to meditation will improve again. So that's how I would look at that, you know, being meditating, yeah. Of course, you need also to put in a little bit of effort, because as you put in effort, you start to understand how your mind works, you start to understand what it means. And when I say, reflect on the meditation afterwards, what do I mean by that? I mean just that you see how your attitude, yeah, influences your meditation. Like, you see how your kind of your perception of the present moment, how that influences your meditation. That means that in the future you are able to set up the right attitude when you meditate. Or if you are not able to establish the right attitude, you may cut the meditation short because you know this may not be the right time. This is what I mean by seeing the causes and the results, how they work together. Okay, so I hope that works. And I see you have number two here, but number two is empty. So you have number one, you work again, and then there's number two, and there's nothing coming after it. That's the really good question, the emptiness question. Okay. Next one. Ajahn, you mentioned we must use wisdom to discern that we come for the retreat, not to become a better person to family, or be better to work, and therefore a better progress on the Dhamma path. Can you please elaborate more on this point? And it is something I need to work on, reflect upon, and ponder seriously. Thank you, Alexander. Okay. I can, and it's important that you don't misunderstand my point. I do not mean that you should be callous and disregard your family. I don't mean that at all. Yeah? I mean exactly the opposite. What I mean is that you start treating your family and your work colleagues and anyone else you meet during the daily life, your BGS colleagues, wherever they are, you start treating them in a way that conforms, that is appropriate from the point of view of the Dhamma practice. Yeah? That's really what I mean then. So when you do that, in part, of course, because you love your family and you want to be friendly with your colleagues, yeah, that's part of it. But you also do it because you know this is going to be beneficial on the Buddhist path. So it has a double benefit, it's a win-win, it's a really, really win-win situation. And I have noticed that I mentioned before how, you know, I found that this with my own family, how powerful it is that when you start treating them with kindness, it changes their outlook so completely. To the point of, you know, that being completely anti-Buddhist and being really negative because you want him as a monk. Until they turn around 180 degrees and they become Buddhist. Why? Well, the Dhamma is very powerful, and because you treat them in the right way. This actually changes people's mind. It's very powerful if you do this consistently over a long period of time. So this double mindedness. So you learn to use your daily life as part of your spiritual practice. Sometimes, you know, people compartmentalize their life. This is my daily life. This is my spiritual practice. But if you do that, you're never going to go very far on the path. Everything has to be part of what I would call spiritual practice. Yeah. So learning to treat people well, learning to treat them with kindness. Learn them to do the right thing. In your family life, it's very challenging in family life because we're so close together. Habits are so strong. It's very easy to get upset for small things. It's also easy to be attached and to be kind as well sometimes. But it's, emotions are very much, you know, they are very much, we're puppets on a string in a sense, yeah? And our family members push our buttons quite easily. Yeah? So if you can able to be more kind in your family life, actually that's a very good sign, because it means that you are progressing, you're challenging some of those habits, and you're kind of doing things differently. Yeah? you know that, you know, instead of getting upset with your children when they do something stupid, okay, you know it's probably more effective to come across as being concerned for their welfare. Yeah, I really, you know, I say this to you because I love you, not because I want to be angry with you. But if you feel upset, you withdraw a little bit until you have clarity of mind again. And these kind of things. But don't think that you're going to succeed straight away with this kind of stuff. It takes time. Yeah, it's a gradual process. Don't get angry with yourself for being angry. Then it gets even worse. But, yeah. And gradually you do this in your office life, in your life at your work. You have lots of opportunities to be kind to your fellow workers. Even if they're not kind to you, you can be kind to them. Yeah, lots of little opportunities in your life. Say a kind word. You know, bring them a drink or something like that with that opportunity. Just open a little door for them. Or just anything which is kind of initially they would look at you as if you're a bit crazy. But after a while, they kind of come to accept that. Yeah, it's actually very beautiful there. We treat each other in kindness in this way. So then you're integrating your personal life, your ordinary life, with the spiritual path, bringing it all together, and that is when it becomes really powerful. It's like at our monastery, you know, one of the things that I have been doing a lot, because when you live with somebody for many, many years, like you do in monastic life, again, it's very easy to fall into bad habits and, you know, judge if this person is like this, and that person is like that, and that kind of stuff. But I have consciously trained myself to understand that actually I'm very fortunate. I live with 25 other people, all of them with very good intentions, trying to live life in the best possible manner. Actually, I'm incredibly fortunate. Yeah, so you train yourself to see the good qualities of other people, rather than focus on the small little things like that. After a while, it's very hard to see the faults in your fellows around you, because you practice so much looking at the positive all the time, and that's all you can see after a while. It works. Yeah, that's kind of the point. This is not some kind of just some kind of ideal that is impossible in practice. Actually, it is possible to do this. I hope that helps a little bit. If it doesn't, then try again next time and see what happens. Okay. Dear Ajahn, thanks for the wonderful intro to meditation. In our attempt to meditate, when thoughts crop up, we are to let them play themselves out, right? But what if the thoughts do not stop? Thought A is the thought B to C, D, E. Wouldn't we get lost if we do not tell ourselves, hey, go back to the breath then? With metta, amara, as amara, as the antimara, that's really good name, antimara. By the way, what does one do in the Vipassana meditation? Just watch the breath? Thanks. Okay. The reason why you are thinking, there's many different things you can do here, but let's just look at some of the ways of challenging the thinking mind. The reason you are thinking is because the mind is kind of resting. The reason you're thinking, guess what the reason is? Because you want to think it. That may not be obvious, because the mind is very subtle, that it's all there at the back of the mind somewhere, but you actually want to think it. So when you stand back and you try just to observe what is going on, instead of actually involving yourself in the thought, standing back, what you're doing is you're withdrawing the will, you're withdrawing that agent that actually creates the thinking mind. Because when you are passive, the passive is the opposite of doing, yeah? So when you're completely passive, just observing it, you're actually taking away an agency which feeds the thinking in the first place. So by being completely passive, ideally, the mind should gradually come down and actually think less. But sometimes it can take a while. Sometimes we have to be very patient. You come here on this retreat, yeah? And on the first couple of days of the retreat, you're coming straight from your ordinary life. The mind is already full of impressions from your ordinary life. It's going to take a while for that to die down. You come even to our retreat center in Perth, which is very beautiful and peaceful. Still, it takes people a while to extract themselves from their ordinary life and kind of be comfortable in the new surroundings. But in the meantime, you're just going to have to be patient. So patient is one of the very important things that in this kind of practice. You will see that the mind becomes gradually more peaceful just by being patient, just by relaxing, just by being aware, just by, you know, being in the present moment. This is one way of doing this. Another way of, and you may be right, maybe this leads on to, you know, thought, B, C, etc. But every time you kind of catch yourself, now I'm thinking, yeah, at that moment you have some mindfulness. Yeah, as long as you're completely gone into the flow of thought, you don't even know that you're thinking, you're just kind of part of the flow in a sense, and suddenly you think, oh, wait a minute, I'm thinking, yeah? And then you kind of, at that moment, you have to regain mindfulness. So at that moment, you just wait, and then hopefully the breath kind of comes back, and then you continue with your breath meditation, or just being silent in the present moment, or whatever it is. This is one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is to try to understand the content of your thought. Yeah? What are you thinking about? Yeah? And once you have some idea what you're thinking about, you have some idea what kind of defilement is driving this. Why are you thinking this? And then you can overcome those defilements. Especially if you're a bit upset about something, you can kind of guide your mind in a different direction. Yeah? This is another way to understand why you are thinking this way. And I'm going to talk about the sutta later on, which is the Vitakka Santana Sutta. It's basically all about the calming of thought. So that is understanding the root, yeah, of where it is coming from, why you are thinking these thoughts. So another way, the reason why we want to think is because we think happiness, we think, yeah, I want to indulge in this, I want to kind of fantasize about that, so we're kind of very happy, we want to think. So what you have to do then when you see that you have to find happiness somewhere else. This is kind of the thing, and if you can find happiness somewhere else, then the thinking mind is going to seem gross in comparison. If you are able to, this is one of the reasons why sometimes it can be very useful to use a bit of metta meditation or some other meditation where you give rise to a bit of happiness and joy. So if you are able to give rise to happiness and joy, this is not easy. A lot of people can't do this, but it's something that you can gradually train yourself to do if you live well. Then, and of course, the mind is going to be, it's going to really subside all the thinking because you are enjoying something else instead. This is why, in the Buddha's teaching, happiness and joy is such a central feature of his teachings, because that is the glue that allows you to stay with the meditation object. Yeah? Bang, glued on, you don't want to go anywhere else. Wow, this is meditation, okay, let's forget about everything else. Remind yourself also of this, what this other person said before, about kind of giving priority to the meditation, giving priority to the spiritual life, and all of this other stuff, but it's not really all that important, it is there to support your spiritual life. So these are some of the ways, but even if you may try all of these things, it may not always be working. So don't get desperate, don't try to use willpower to stop your thinking, even if that happens. Just bear with it, and just kind of stay with it, and then eventually it will start to die down, because that's just the nature of the thinking mind. Try some of that and see what happens, and if nothing happens, then ask the question again and see what we can do. So say, go back to the breath, you can say that. But it must be better to allow the breath to re-arise. Yeah? Because if you say, hey, go back to the breath, that's already, you're using a bit of willpower there, okay, grab onto the breath, go back to the breath again. Once you kind of, your mindfulness gets re-established, just wait for the breath to come back. And then kind of the breath will be arising. It's just a skillful means to avoid too much doing, that's really all it is. There's always going to be some doing then, because it's very hard to avoid altogether, but it's just a skillful way of minimizing the doing. Okay, by the way, what does one do in Vipassana meditation? Just watch your breath, watch your writing. Thank you. This is strange, this idea of Vipassana meditation and Samatha meditation. And we make so much of this distinction, and the world talks about as if they're the Buddha taught two different types of meditation, but actually the Buddha never used the word vipassana meditation, nor does he use the word samatha meditation. For the Buddha there's only one thing, that's called meditation, that's all there is, bhavana. So actually this modern idea of this distinction between the two is that it can be a bit misleading here. So usually what they call vipassana meditation is the equivalent to satipatthana practice. You practice the four satipatthanas, and they call that vipassana meditation. But actually, it's both samatha and vipassana. And this is one of those things that when you read the suttas broadly, you recognize that whenever you're having success in meditation, you get two results. Two results are samatha, if you please, from a karma. The other result is you see things more clearly, vipassana. They're always arise together. That's why they have a compound, samatha vipassana, in the suttas. They always work together like that. Some of the greatest meditation teachers in the modern era, like Ajahn Chah, I'm a Brahms teacher, he says samatha vipassana is like two sides of a knife. You can't have a one-sided knife, you've got to have two sides. Or maybe that's a Zen koan, the one-sided knife. Stops you like that. But if it is not Zen koan, then it has two sides. Yeah? It's only Zen koan that has one side, so it has two sides. Because it has two sides, it always comes together. And when you think about it, it's so obvious why that has to be the case. And the reason it is so obvious is because what hinders samatha is the presence of the five hindrances. What hinders vipassana is the presence of the five hindrances. So the whole purpose of the path is to purify our minds and reduce the five hindrances, because the five hindrances go down. You have more samatha and you have more vipassana. Yeah, it has to be like that. It can't really be any other way. So these are just names that are given to particular ways of doing meditation. So in the Mahasi method, the idea is that you call it vipassana method, but what you're doing is noting things, And so you're taking a noting, doing this, doing that. I'm not sure if that necessarily is the ideal way of practicing meditation. Works for some, may not work for others. Some people get stuck on the noting. They keep on noting. The mind doesn't go silent because they're noting all the time. So they can have detrimental side effects, some of these methods. The Gwenta method, and this is another bit of the Vipassana method, you start off with a breath meditation, and then you go on to noting the feelings in the body. That's another way of doing it. But again, if it works, it has both samatha and also vipassana in the ultimate. But according to the Buddha, if you want to practice satipatthana, which is what is normally called, what vipassana is often called vipassana, satipatthana, vipassana often equated. But the Buddha says all you have to do to practice satipatthana is to watch the breath. If you watch the breath, you fulfill all the four satipatthanas as a consequence. That fulfills the seven factors of awakening, which fulfills vijja vimutti, which is the insight and liberation. That's all you have to do. It's so simple. Keep it really, really simple. All you have to do is watch the breath. Of course, watching the breath is not so easy always. You think, oh, I'm going to watch the breath. Okay, then an hour later you have watched two breaths, and you wonder where you went. This happens sometimes with people. But at least it is easy to understand the instructions. And now you just have to apply them one way or another. So yes, vipassana meditation is also watching the breath. When you watch the breath and you're having success, guess what happens? You get two things, samatha and vipassana. Especially after a deep and very successful breath meditation, there's two kinds of vipassana. The vipassana arises naturally with the deepening of the meditation, but also after the meditation, you review it, and in that reviewing, you can get really powerful insight as a consequence. That's also an aspect of vipassana. And also samatha, because when you have insight, you also become peaceful. How do you measure insight? How do you know that you have real insight? By how peaceful you are. If it is a real insight, you become incredibly peaceful. Why? Because insight is into the three characteristics, dukkha, anicca, and anatta. If you really have insight into dukkha, it means you let go, because you're not holding on to dukkha. When you let go, you become peaceful. So you can measure your insight by how peaceful you are. Otherwise, you might get the wrong idea. right, I think that makes a bit of sense. If not, please come back on this question, and we will talk about it more later on. Okay. Why is there a humming sound around my head during meditation then? Good question. Have you noticed a fly flies around your head across the corner? That is the air conditioning. The air conditioning is making a little noise. There can be many reasons for that. Sometimes it's just the mind is so active, it's like a humming, like an engine inside of you, running on empty, so to speak. That is a possibility. It could be something to do with your ears, and maybe it's some kind of problem with the ears. That's not a possibility. Just check it out as you go through the next few days in your meditation, see what happens to the humming sound. Does it decrease? And then after a while, we start to find out where it comes from. But it could just be that your ears are kind of not functioning 100%, so they're making humming sound. Or sometimes it's just your mind being so active that it's kind of almost like it's humming like an engine in there. Any of these things are possible. Don't worry too much about it. It's kind of irrelevant. As long as the way to know whether your meditation is going well or not, if you find that you are at ease, you are relaxed, you're not confused, you're not getting angry, if these negative thoughts are there and you start to feel really bad, then the humming sound may not be such a good thing. People often say, I have all these strange perceptions, my body is floating, we're becoming larger. Very, very common in meditation practice. But doesn't matter at all. It's completely irrelevant. It's just the mind making stuff up. And only if your mind is getting into a bad state, confused, angry, ill will, and that is getting worse, that is the only time you need to be worried. If your mind is at ease, and you're relaxed, and you're enjoying yourself, it is no problem. Okay, humming sound. Here I am. What do you think about a monk who keep the image but not practice in Thailand? Keep the image but not practice in Thailand. Yeah, this is a very common thing. One of the things that you notice in Buddhism is that looking right is very important. So you wear your robe in a nice way, and you talk in a nice way, and all these kind of things. But when it actually comes to the real practice, it may not be so good. And the sutta I have, the sutta the Buddha said, there's monks or nuns or anyone, it's like four types of container, I think it is, or four types of containers. When there is the container which is open, it is full but it's open, and the empty container is open, the empty container which is closed, and the full container which is closed. So the empty container is like someone who hasn't got any kind of spiritual qualities, they're kind of wandering around, but they're kind of empty of spiritual qualities. But the lid is open, so you can see everything, you see straight away, this person, empty of spiritual qualities. But then there's an empty one with a lid, looks the part, robe is perfect, and kind of everything is kind of right, demeanor is kind of right, but actually the empty of spiritual qualities inside that. They look right, but they're actually empty. And then there's the person which is full, but has no lid on them. And this is the kind of person who is like, really good spiritual qualities, but when you look at them, the demeanor is kind of a bit slack, the demeanor is not perfect. So it's a bit like Asabram, the robe is falling off. You see, Asabram, the robe is kind of all over the place. This is what I love about Asabram. He takes himself so seriously. He's kind of so relaxed in that thing. And then you have the monastic who is full of spiritual qualities and also really look the part. Look absolutely perfect and absolutely right. So these are the four. So because of this, we have to be observed quite carefully to know whether someone actually has really good spiritual qualities or not. And to do that, what you have to do is you have to observe over a long period of time. It takes a long time to see that. And this is one of the great things about having a close relationship with a teacher, with somebody. You had a Rob coming to BGF now for how long? 20 years, I think. 20 years, well, it's a long time, isn't it? Yeah. So after a while you know him, you know what he's like, yeah? You get some idea what he's like. I've only been coming here for 5 years or something, so you barely know me at all by comparison. So, and that is a good thing, because after a while you gain a sense of trust, you gain a sense of, yes, this is the real deal, yeah? And this is one of those benefits of that. So observe carefully, observe for a long period of time, and then you will know which monastics are more trustworthy than others. You may never be absolutely sure, because it's very hard to be absolutely sure, but you get a rough idea of where you can place your confidence and faith. And once you know that, what you should do, you should support those monastics who practice properly, who practice well. Yeah? That is where you should put your main support. And that is where you should get your main faith, of course. And it only makes sense, because, and the reason for that is very simple, because if we want Buddhism to thrive in the future, the only way it's going to thrive is because people actually have real results in the practice, and they practice in the right way, and then and the results will be there, and the proper dhamma will be passed on into future generations. So if someone is slacked, they will pass that slackness on to the next generation. The next generation will also be slacked, yeah? If someone practices well, then the chances are they will actually practice, pass on that good practice to future generations. So support those who feel the right practice is being done. That is the appropriate way. And one of the ways of knowing that is also, you know, are monastics practicing in the forest? Yeah, I'm not suggesting that all monastics who practice in the city are necessarily bad, but that's not really the point. The point is more that if anyone is going to get results in the meditation practice, those people, those monastics who practice in the forest are far more likely to get results. In fact, I mentioned here last year that in the Parinibbana Sutta, the Buddha specifically says that if for the future benefit of the Buddhism, if Buddhism is not going to decline, and Buddhism is going to kind of uphold and even expand and improve and get better, the only way that's going to happen is as long as the monastics delight in forest projects. This is actually very important. It's so important that the future of Buddhism, in many ways, depends on it. Yeah, it's kind of astonishing. You wouldn't think the seven things the Buddha says that are in that particular sutta, Mahaparinibbana, seven things that are supportive for future well-being of Buddhism, and that is one of those seven things. So very important. So think like that. Think, you know, don't be afraid of using your common sense and your judgment. Don't think that, you know, judging a monk is bad karma, you're going to go to hell if you kind of judge a monk and you say, oh, this monk, I don't think he's an arahant, yeah? Oh, that's bad karma, don't say that. It's okay, you're an arahant, you can't say that. It's not bad, it's good karma to say that. Because someone is behaving badly, then it's good to be honest about that. You kind of close your eyes, oh, don't want to see, yeah? It's not going to get in anywhere now. Because that is going to drag Buddhism down if we are not connected. I see too much of that. And if you're talking about China specifically, and in China there's a lot of that stuff. You don't want to see the reality because you think it's bad karma. It's not bad karma at all. It's good karma to see the reality. The Buddha specifically says in the sutta that those people who are worthy of this praise, we should dispraise them. Not a lot, not kind of be in a gross and bad way, but when necessary, so that other people don't get led astray, we should dispraise those people who are worthy of dispraise, and those people who are worthy of praise, we should praise them. And then we are helping to guide others in the right direction. If we just close our eyes and we refuse to see the reality of things, we're not taking responsibility for what's going on. There's too much fear of making bad karma, but actually, you're making good karma by being honest about the way things are. Not making bad karma at all. As long as your intention is good and you're trying to show what is really there, you're doing the right thing. So that is the way to deal about that. The monks who are keeping the image and not practice. And don't be afraid if a monk really is bad. There are obviously a lot of monks who don't practice properly. And if you see something really bad, don't be afraid of bringing it up with, you know, the abbot of the monastery and with some authority somewhere, and, you know, some higher authority, and say, I've seen this. Don't be afraid of that. Because when you do that, you're actually supporting the integrity of Buddhism in the long run. If it's only small things, you know, you don't have to worry too much about it. Okay, a monk is using money. It's not invariably deal if a monk uses a little bit of money discreetly. Ideally, one aspect should not use money at all, but if they use a little bit of paper bus or whatever, it's not a massive thing. But if monks get into all kind of really dodgy stuff, you know, like, I mean, you hear some really radical stories like drug dealing and you know, and having a wife and that kind of stuff, then it is really, really problematic. And that is where the right thing to do is to kind of talk to the authorities about it. So, don't be too worried. Try to, you know, these things are important. It's important that people also plan their part. And so then we can hopefully all together keep it more, help Buddhism to grow also into the future. It's also important to remember that there's lots of really good monks in Thailand as well. And don't, you know, and sometimes when you hang out with those good monks, you feel really good, you feel really, really happy. One of my favorite monks who I visited a couple of years ago, Ajahn Gampa, he's great, he's a really, really nice monk. He lives up in the Taoyuan National Park. He's very nice. Ajahn Kukri, I visited also a couple of years ago, he's the one who has started runs the Buddha Marsha group in Thailand. He seems to be a fairly good monk. There has been some criticism of him recently. I'm not entirely sure what is going on there, but I think he had a good impression to me. And there is quite a few monks like that around us. So support those and go to listen to those, and you will feel uplifted and things will go well in Thailand and everywhere else for that matter. Okay. Everybody happy? Yes? Okay. Yeah, good then. That's all the questions for today. So if you have any more questions later on, please just know them here. Or any questions, okay. I accept all questions. And if the question, if I feel the question is inappropriate, I will just throw it out. Yeah. So don't, but usually, I don't think I've been one for 20, what is it, 2 years or whatever, and I have never ever yet thrown out a single question. So you don't have to worry too much. Okay, so that's it for tonight. So keep on enjoying yourself and don't meditate too much. There comes a point when you don't want to meditate anymore. That's okay, yeah? And you can just chill a little bit and relax instead. So just find that balance. Make sure you're enjoying what you're doing. And then I will be back here tomorrow morning at 6:30. We'll have a group meditation at 6:30 tomorrow morning. In the meantime, have a good night, sleep well, enjoy yourself, and see you.